Our second case this morning is United States against Rogers. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. The issue in this case is whether the military judge abused his discretion in denying appellant's motion to suppress his hair test results. This issue comes down to the question of whether, under the totality of the circumstances, the commander had a substantial basis for determining that probable cause existed in this case, and the answer is no. The first reason probable cause did not exist in this case is the reckless and misleading affidavit presented by the OSI agent. This affidavit must be viewed through the lens of an agent who actually flat out lied about who he was. The commander in this case, who issued the search authorization, testified that Agent McPherson told him he was a major. On page 143 of the joint appendix, the commander said, "He's a major. He told me that he was a major." That commander also testified that he was under the impression Agent McPherson was the commander of that detachment. The problem with that is that Agent McPherson was not a major. He wasn't even an officer, and he certainly was not the commander of the detachment. This agent actually violated Article UCMJ, said he was an officer, he was impersonating an officer. The prosecution, in fact, stipulated to those facts. Specifically, the military judge abused his discretion in his findings of fact in paragraph 10, when the military judge nonetheless found Agent McPherson credible. Military judge was abused his discretion in finding the fact because he did not note that testimony of the colonel. In fact, the military judge left all of that out in his findings of fact, while noting that he was credible, but not noting the problems with what he said. The problem with the affidavit itself is that it's misleading. It lists a positive 2004 your analysis that the appellant had at Maxwell Air Force Base, which is indeed a fact. There was a positive your analysis. But Agent McPherson did not list in that affidavit that he was also acquitted at a court-martial in April 2004.
In paragraph 18, the military judge goes through some of the stuff. He says, although Agent McPherson's affidavit left out some information that the court believes a military magistrate should be informed of when a search authorization is sought, is it your contention that the military judge missed essential things here in the omissions list? You're saying the military judge abused his discretion, and you just said he abused his discretion in part because he didn't even realize things had been omitted.
Yes, Your Honor.
But here he says, I realized things were omitted and they should have been included.
Correct, and perhaps I misspoke.
And so my question is, what is your argument that he didn't list everything, or what's your argument?
It's twofold, Your Honor. First, the military judge found that he said that there are certain things that were important that should have been in this affidavit that weren't. I believe that's what you're referencing. One, the not guilty verdict of Maxwell, the negative year analysis of Fort Meade, and the fact that the agent told the commander that the appellant had denied these allegations. None of these were in the affidavit, but the judge found that he orally briefed that. It's our position that those were erroneous findings of fact with that. The commander who took the stand said...
Well, that's not what he said. It is highly unlikely he would have told Colonel McCoy. He's not saying that he did tell him necessarily, but go ahead. He's saying notwithstanding that, though, based on the totality of the information, he still finds probable cause. Now, what's wrong with that?
Your Honor, in paragraph 10 of the findings of fact, he said that those things that were left out of the affidavit, the three I just mentioned, he found that the agent did orally brief those to the commander.
He found that he testified that he orally briefed them.
Yes, Your Honor.
A little different, but...
Yes, Your Honor.
If I'm still trying to get what your argument is, what did the military judge miss as to what was missing is question one. Because he's doing a totality of the circumstances, and one of the circumstances is that the magistrate wasn't told everything, which you're pointing out.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it, the military judge seems to have factored that in to his analysis of the totality of the circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor. Based on the testimony of Agent McPherson and the commander, he said that I believe Agent McPherson verbally briefed this to him. The problem is that the commander who took the stand said, he said two things. One, I don't recall ever being briefed these factors, and then admitted under cross-examination that he in fact told defense counsel that Agent McPherson did not brief those factors to him. So when looking at those, it's our position that these are erroneous findings of fact. I mean, you have an agent who's lying about who he is. I mean, the only thing we really know, the only thing the commander remembers is he told me he was a major. All of these things that the military judge found that Agent McPherson briefed orally to the commander that were missing from the affidavit, that the military judge said were important for missing from the affidavit, the commander doesn't remember. So in weighing the totality of the circumstances between an agent who misrepresented who he was and said, oh, no, of course I verbally briefed those.
What about the subordinate supervisor relationship and the alleged disciplinary actions? Where is that found in the testimony, and how was that treated below?
The Agent McPherson also said that he did orally brief this information to the commander. If you look at the affidavit, that is something else that is missing. In the affidavit, it just says that Senior Airman Thomas was at the home of the appellant. It doesn't say why that's there. The record of trial reveals that it was a counseling session, if you will. Appellant was the supervisor of Airman Thomas. There had been a missing document that was important for that section, and he called her over. Also, in the record of trial, it says that this is the second time he's counseled her, and that he told her again that if he had to counsel her again, there'd be a letter of reprimand and potentially a UIF, unfavorable information file, started on her. That information was not presented to the commander. In fact, the commander testified. He said, I saw this as somebody who went to a party, saw something, and then reported it. Now, even the commander, after the fact, understanding that this wasn't a party, in motion practice, I mean, hopefully he would know, you know, motion practice after the fact that, okay, this wasn't a party, you know, he learned more facts. But even motion practice said, I saw this as someone who went to a party. So the veracity of Airman Thomas really wasn't tested. Agent McPherson said, originally because Airman Thomas presented herself as a victim, there were some allegations of sexual misconduct on the part of appellant, that he did not look into the veracity of Airman Thomas. He did go talk to her coworkers. She did go back, and initially she said, well, I went to appellant's home, and she mentioned the alleged sexual misconduct. She didn't really get into cocaine. She did at a later time. Now, if you read the affidavit, it just says she went and reported everything.
Well, does there have to be a discussion of the person's reliability when, one, she's not an informant, and two, Aguilar and Spadelli are out the window?
Your Honor, in totality of circumstances, yes. So you would look at Tipton in cases like this. I mean, you know, she's in a position of she's a military member. She's not, an anonymous.
Is she an informant?
She was an informant, Your Honor.
Oh, she was an informant. Are you saying?
No, Your Honor, she wasn't working for OSI.
No, she wasn't working for OSI. She wasn't an informant. Aguilar and Spinelli apply to informants. She wasn't an informant. Where does that leave you? I mean, even assuming the continued validity of Aguilar and Spinelli, which is another question entirely.
She was not an informant. In the totality of circumstances, as far as that subordinate relationship, her motive to fabricate potentially should have been made known to the commander. Commander was totally not aware of that, and
he was not aware of a subordinate superior relationship between the two.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Also, if you look at the Special Agent Gage is an OSI forensic consultant. His opinion factors in this affidavit, and it was his opinion that because the appellant ingested three lines of cocaine, it's his opinion that he was a chronic drug user. Well, it's even more important then to look at this negative year analysis. Yes, it's 4 days later, but the reason why this is misleading is because You know, we're talking about a positive year analysis 16 months ago, not listening to court martial. We're talking about a forensic consultant giving his opinion that he must be a chronic drug user, but then not telling the commander that, in fact, there was a negative year analysis done 4 days ago. Well, if he's a chronic user, he's using it on a Thursday, would it be there Monday? Who knows? But if he's a chronic user, it means all the time. I mean, maybe he's using it over the weekend. And that's another reason that this affidavit is misleading. The commander was not made aware of that fact. For this, the second reason also, that the commander really didn't follow up on some of these things. He didn't really go into a substantial basis for it. Speaking of that negative year analysis, afterwards, I mean, at that time he didn't find out it was negative year analysis, but he did learn that. And he said even if he had been told there was a negative year analysis, it would not have affected his decision because it was his belief he was a chronic user and he had popped positive once before. This was a commander who, regardless of the facts, was determined to grant the search authorization. He did not ask the agent really about Senior Airman Thomas and who she was. I mentioned before, just thought she was someone who went to a party. This is the first search authorization that this commander was giving. You think that it would stick out a little bit in his mind. Now, Agent McPherson did say, oh, well, I orally briefed him about the negative year analysis. And Agent McPherson said, even when I orally briefed him about this negative year analysis, he didn't even ask any follow-up questions, and he didn't even react. This is a commander who's going to issue a search authorization to take someone's hair to look for long-term use of drugs, and he hears that someone says, I saw him use drugs, and there's a negative year analysis, and he's not even reacting to that. He's not asking any follow-up questions to that, and relying on a single paragraph in an affidavit from Agent Gage, who said, well, he must be a chronic user, so it should be there. Well, chronic user or not, he has a negative year analysis, but that wouldn't factor to me. Also, the commander did not consult the legal office after. Well, I should back up. Agent McPherson called the legal office. He talked to him about the facts. Then he did not go and coordinate the affidavit through the legal office. Agent McPherson said this was an oversight. Another oversight was the commander also, after getting his briefing from Agent McPherson, did not talk to the legal office. If we look at U.S. v. Lopez, it says it's significant that the commander act only after consulting the local staff judge advocate. He didn't do so in this case, and on cross-examination, he said, well, I'm the commander. It's like with anything. If I had someone consulting on an Article 15 or a courts martial, It's I'm the commander. I listen to the advice and then I make the decision. Well, in this case,
was this command directed or was he playing the role of a magistrate?
He was playing the role of the magistrate, Your Honor.
No, he's supposed to go to the government's lawyer to play the role of the neutral, detached magistrate.
Yes.
See what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're dinging him for not going to the SJA or whomever who had advised the law enforcement side, and now you're saying he should have gone to them to ask them if there is probable cause so that he could play the role of a neutral and detached magistrate and decide whether there is probable cause. That doesn't strike you as somewhat peculiar?
It does, Your Honor. One thing that potentially could have helped in this case is because Agent McPherson talked to the legal office but then didn't run the affidavit by them. Perhaps if this affidavit was actually viewed by...
Which is a different argument.
Yes,
you credit right. For a different argument, yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, I can see that in trying to be neutral and detached, perhaps that's what he was going through or going for in that regard.
Counsel, you, in that light, while a person acting as a magistrate, some of the case law indicates may get some credit, or agents who are seeking a warrant may get some credit for going to a legal office. Is there any case that holds that there's a demerit for not doing so?
No, Your Honor. No, that power absolutely lies with the magistrate.
So what difference does it make in this case? In other words, there may not be any credit there, but if there's no demerit, what difference does it make?
I think in looking in total how this commander looked at it, how he was just kind of a rubber stamp, he was going to give this regardless of whether there was a negative year analysis, whether whether he remembered anything. In fact, you know, first he said, I wasn't told these things, and then he doesn't remember. And then when he was, he's not reacting. I mean, this is an agent, I guess just overall, Your Honor, would be our argument, or pardon me, the commander overall who was determined to grant the search authorization. I see that my time is up.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. I am Captain Matt Osborne, and I, along with Colonel Gerald R. Bruce, represent the United States in this matter. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in this case in denying the appellant's motion to suppress his hair test results, as the search was supported by probable cause. Further, even assuming arguendo that probable cause did not exist in this case, the hair test results would still have been admissible under the good faith exception. Now, speaking with probable cause, it's important to remember that the issue before this court today is not whether Special Agent McPherson, the OSI agent in this case, could have prepared a stronger affidavit for Colonel McCoy, the commander in search of authorization in this case. The issue before this court is whether, under the totality of the circumstances, the information presented to Colonel McCoy provided him with a substantial basis in determining that probable cause existed. And also keeping in mind that when we're talking about probable cause, we're talking about a practical, common sense decision that, given all the circumstances set forth to the search authority, that there's a fair probability that the evidence of the contraband is going to be in that particular place. This requirement does not demand any showing that such a belief be correct or more likely true than false. It merely requires that a person of reasonable caution could believe that a search may reveal evidence of the crime. And also, probable cause doesn't require showing that an event is more than 50% likely.
The appellant went through his menu of totality of circumstances on his side of the scale. Failure to test the credibility of witnesses, matters omitted. He did not hear, but in his brief argued about the nexus issue in the 53 days, some atmospherics involved in first affidavit, first warrant, and the 2004 acquittal, okay? What's on your side of the ledger in a menu format?
In terms of the totality of, or the overall info that was before Colonel McCoy to make his final determination, first, he's got the statements of Senior Airman Thomas, who's the witness here. This is a witness who personally witnessed the appellant inhale multiple, three lines of cocaine. So we're not talking about a second or third party person, and as appellant's counsel admitted earlier, we're not talking about an OSI confidential informant or someone who's unknown. We also have the amount of drugs that was seen by the witness, Sarah Thomas, in that she saw a large section and then another small section of three lines, which is the section that he actually used. We also have that he offered some of the cocaine to her and used a short straw to snort that cocaine.
Just to be clear, what's on your side of the ledger other than through the testimony of Senior Airman Thomas? You're welcome to then highlight her testimony, but I'm just trying to get my menu prepared.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've got the corroboration of the statements that she's got. And that is that she immediately reported to her supervisors, and also within the day was speaking to OSI about the issues. We also have the corroboration that she knew about the appellant's prior court-martial, which through the testimony showed that was something that was not well known throughout the unit. So the fact she testified that he told her that in relation to him not being worried about testing positive on your analysis because he takes a substance to hide that. So that corroborates the statements that she's got. We also know that he, through the affidavit, there was input from the OSI forensic science consultant that said that if someone uses, chronically uses, then it's a likelihood that the drug would be found in the hair. And then he also went on to say that considering the, you know, the evidence that I've heard in this case, I think that the appellant is a chronic user.
Was there any evidence that it would be in the hair 54 days later?
That was not specifically stated. However, we have evidence of the commander's own prior knowledge of hair testing, that he knew that drugs would stay in the hair, what he said, quote, much longer than it would in urine.
It seems to me that the chronic user testimony from the forensic expert indicates that if you're a chronic user, it's going to stay in your, it's going to be in your hair. You can find it in the hair. And if that's the case, was he talking about drug use after the incident that we're talking about, that he was charged with? He was charged with drug use on that particular day, and we're now talking 54 days later.
Correct. He was charged with drug use on that day, and I believe about a month and a half before on the charge sheet. I think it can go both ways in terms of possible drug use after or drug use before. I think the possible drug use after is the fact that he had, after he had used the three lines of cocaine, he still had that pile on the plate that he didn't use in front of her. In terms of that evidence that he had used before, we've got to look at, you know, him offering her drugs. It's very clear, based on the testimony of Airman Thomas, that he was pretty open and blatant about his use, and that this didn't exactly seem to be the first time that he had used. And that fact is buttressed by him saying that he takes a substance to clear his unit.
But the hair test was used to help convict him for the use 54 days prior. Is that correct?
Correct. Okay. 54 days prior, and like I said, the window of, I believe, about a month and a half.
Okay.
That was the full.
You can keep doing your list now for Judge Baker.
So the fact that, you know, that's evidence that he had used in, had used before, and so that he was a multiple time, and that this was not, I mean, this is not the case to where she walked in a bathroom and he's got just a little bit of cocaine and you know, he gets embarrassed and that type of thing. He's openly offering it to her. So I think that's evidence that of chronic use beforehand. Additionally, what was before Colonel McCoy is that he knew that an attorney at the base legal office had been consulted by the OSI agent and had opined that probable cause would exist in this case. Now, I say that not to say that he used that opinion as his sole basis, but you know, the case law says that he is allowed to use opinions of others as long as he doesn't advocate his role as the ultimate decision maker. And in fact, during testimony, he was specifically asked about that, and he would make it very abundantly clear that he knows that he gets advice from law enforcement, he gets advice from legal offices, he even gets advice from his first sergeants, but he and he alone is the one who makes the ultimate decision on these types of cases. And then, as I said earlier, we also know that he had his own prior knowledge of hair testing, and also knew about the testing windows for a urinalysis and how quick they are. Which would go into the fact of him understanding the negative UA that was in this case, but understanding still that hair could still show drug use from that time. And then finally, we know that he was told about the negative aspects of this case in terms of the government's position for getting search authorization. He knew about the negative UA. He also knew about the accused denial of the accusations. And then, like I said, for corroboration purposes, he knew about that prior acquittal.
And that's based on paragraph 10? Your record evidence that he knew those things?
That's correct. When it said the defense has sought to attack the credibility of Agent McPherson, the court finds his testimony credible and finds that he orally informed.
This is based on the sentence, however, Agent McPherson testified he orally discussed all these matters with Colonel McCoy, followed by his statement about credibility.
This is paragraph 10.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
If I could follow up on that, my concern there is that in the other findings of fact, the military judge made findings of fact. He said this happened, this happened, this happened. Here, he's saying Agent McPherson testified. He's not saying that he orally discussed the matters with Colonel McCoy. He's just saying that this guy testified, which is a little bit subtly different than making a finding that, in fact, he did.
Well, but if you go to the last sentence, it says the court finds his testimony credible and finds that he orally informed Colonel McCoy of the previously noted details that were missing from the affidavit. So I think that clears up any existing time that he, in fact, directly did tell him that.
Would this affidavit been sufficient without the additional oral testimony?
The government's position that it would have, although it would certainly admit that it would be a much closer case. But, you know, like I said, the law states that we're supposed to look at everything that was put before him, including things that were personally known before him, personally known by him. And then, in terms of the overall meeting with the special agent, we know that he met with the special agent for 25 to 30 minutes, was the testimony that was there, that he asked questions that he had about the affidavit, including specifically asked questions about the negative portions of the case, including the appellant's denial and the negative urine.
Did you get to finish your menu?
That was about the last one.
What is your response, please, to Appellant's statement that McPherson held himself out to be a major and that stuff? Your response, both, do you agree with that statement of the facts? And two, if so, what?
I don't know necessarily if that was the case or not. Colonel McCoy certainly testified that he understood him to be a major and also understood him to be the special agent in charge. As it turns out, I believe the reason he thought that he thought he was a special agent in charge is because Colonel McCoy had just taken over command of his group a couple of weeks before, and the OSI agent had been the one to come to speak with him. In terms of the major, like I said, he said that he understood him to be a major or that he told him that he was or not. In terms of how to retort to that,
Doesn't that go to credibility?
It does, but at the same time, that was something that was put before the judge, and the judge did not find that.
The judge didn't mention it one way or the other.
Correct.
Where does it say it was put before the judge?
I'm sorry?
That bit. But where is it in the findings of fact and conclusions of law?
It wasn't. That's why I said it was not put in his findings of fact.
So how do we know it was put before the judge?
The Colonel McCoy testified to that. That, did you know what rank he was? And I believe he says that I thought he was a major, or he told me he was a major, or something of that nature. I will say this, though, that, you know, whether he was a major or whether he was a airman first class, that really doesn't matter when we're looking at, what we thought about.
Don't you think that matters as to credibility? If you misrepresent what you are, particularly if you're an enlisted individual and say, I'm a major, you're going to get more credibility from that colonel sitting across the desk from you.
True.
And it seems to me that a misrepresentation of status, particularly in the military, does go to the credibility of the individual.
Correct. It does, but at the same time, what I mean by it shouldn't matter is because of the standard that we're looking at and the standard that he's got to find. When we're talking about Colonel McCoy, he never testified that, you know, my thoughts on Special Agent McPherson is what drove this. His thoughts on Special Agent McPherson wasn't exactly in play. You know, he was going off, granted he's going off what Agent McPherson is telling him in terms of the negative things and that type of thing. It's important to note too that, you know, the judge in paragraph 18 mentions that had it been Agent McPherson's intent to mislead, it's highly unlikely he would have told Colonel McCoy about the accused negative urine analysis and that he was found not guilty in a court martial.
Can you be very clear what your position is on whether or not he held himself out to be a major versus whether Colonel McCoy thought he was a major, and then cite specifically what page in the record supports your statement?
And it's the government's position is that it's Colonel McCoy who thought that Special Agent McPherson held himself out to be a major. Special Agent McPherson certainly did not testify that I told him how he was a major. Can you just 1 second to...
What, page 108, I think is what you're looking for. Or 108 of the record, 143 of the joint appendix.
That's correct. What was your impression of his rank then? He's a major. He told me he was a major.
Well, in the affidavit that he provided, did he provide the affidavit to the colonel?
He did.
And doesn't it say there SA U.S. Air Force?
Correct. It's only a special agent. He did not list his rank, his actual rank.
Counsel, I'm not asking you to testify here, but is there anything we could take judicial notice of as to what the rank structure is of special agents?
Usually, I believe, and you know, I'm totally sure, but usually in the major to lieutenant colonel, I believe, are the special agents in charge, or the kind of the detachment commanders, and then the normal everyday agents. And in fact, here we know that Special Agent McPherson was somewhat new. And if you look at the affidavit, he says that he's new. He says that I've been an agent since, I believe, some date in 2004. This was in 2005. So, you know, looking at that, it seems to show that he was a fairly new agent. And those would be usually listed in here.
Was this issue with respect to whether he was holding himself out to be something that he was not, was it raised either before the military judge or at the CCA level, or is this something that's just come up here?
It's just come up here.
Thank you.
I will say, after Colonel McCoy got off the stand, the defense asked to have some kind of judicial notice or whatnot with the trial judge to say that he was, in fact, not a major and not the detachment commander. The government agreed with that, and that was the end. And that's the last that's been heard.
So it's also your argument that it's not part of the totality of the circumstances before the military judge? Whatever it is.
Correct.
It's not part of the totality.
Well, it's something to be put before the judge. However, it's not something that's going to lower the amount of evidence.
No, I understand that. Yeah, that's different. Okay. Hello. Thank you.
Quickly, the few things that were mentioned by the appellant in terms of their direct issues, one talking about the misleadingness or the omissions of the affidavit, I think we've kind of already cleared that up, and that the judge found that that testimony was given and that information was given to the commander. He also mentioned the fact that Colonel McCoy was a rubber stamp or disinterested. Once again, Colonel McCoy definitely asked plenty of questions.
I hope he's disinterested. He may not be, they're saying he's uninterested. I would hope he's disinterested. I would hope he's neutral.
Right, neutral and detached, that's absolutely correct. And he certainly showed that, and as I said, specifically on the record at 106, when he talks about that his role as a commander is to get advice and then make his own independent determination. And then lastly, in terms of talking about the credibility of Senior Airman Thomas, once again, that's one of the main issues that the appellant looks at, but we would submit that is just but one factor to look at, and it's something that shouldn't be overly emphasized. But we've also got to look at, once again, she was not an informant. She was a witness who directly saw her. And looking at United States versus Tipton and that line of cases in terms of the unique truth-telling of a service member and those type of issues, I think under the fair probability standard, her credibility was certainly met there. And finally, in terms of if this court should find that probable cause does not exist, we would just submit that the good faith exception does apply here, and that the evidence of the hair test should still apply. If there's any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Airman Thomas had mentioned that appellant had told her he used a substance to clean his system, and that's why he wasn't concerned about coming up positive on your analysis. She told Agent McPherson that substance was called strip. Agent McPherson went to investigate that and actually didn't find any cleansing agent called strip. That was another fact that was left out of the affidavit. We're talking about corroboration.
Wait a minute. Is what you're saying that the appellant called some masking agent by an informal name, and there's no such informal name recorded?
Yes, Your Honor.
That didn't seem to carry a whole lot of weight. I mean, you know, they could call it anything they wanted to. But
yes, Your Honor. Once again, just as far as being misleading, all of those factors could have been put in there. Of course, it could have been a street name or not the scientific name for that. But just another factor to consider. There was a lot of discussion of this corroboration of diverse use, and I'm sure Your Honor's aware, in fact, the appellant stands convicted only of a one-time use here. In the end, our position is the reason why the military judge's findings of fact are clearly erroneous as to what the agent briefed the commander is because the military judge said, I find that Agent McPherson briefed the commander of this missing information that wasn't in there. But yet we have the colonel on the stand who said, I never recall being briefed that. And then he also said prior in his defense, in his interviews with defense counsel, he said, yes, I told defense counsel, in fact, he did not brief me on those. So when we have an agent whose credibility is at stake here, and we don't really have a credibility issue with Colonel McCoy. I mean, he's an ops group commander at Fort Meade. Seemingly, he's a man of credibility, and yet we have an agent who's lying about who he was.
Well, when you say he's lying about who he was, I mean, it seems to me that you're making much of what the colonel thought he was, as opposed to what he represented himself to be. You're making much more of it here than was ever made at the hearing itself or at the CCA. I'm just suggesting that one would think that if that was an issue, that much would have been made of it before the military judge, don't you think?
I think, Your Honor, that the commander was very clear on page 108, 143 of the Joint Appendix. He said he told me he was a major. It was his impression that he was the commander of the detachment. But on that line, it says he told me he was a major. That's our position. The commander could not have been much more clear about that. And when looking at these findings of facts, we've got this agent saying, well, of course I told him. And then we've got the commander saying, either he didn't, or I don't recall. And between those two, the tie definitely shouldn't go to somebody who said he was a major and left the impression, Your Honor, will admit that the colonel did say I was just the impression that he was a commander.
Well, you argue that the tie shouldn't go to him, but isn't the presumption in law that if it's a close case, it goes to the prevailing party, to the government in this case?
It is, unless it's reckless or misleading. In a close call, yes, Your Honor, the presumption does go towards the government, but not when they're reckless and misleading and not when they're presenting this information to the magistrate. And the final point for appellants is just that with Leon, a good faith doesn't apply for all the same reasons we've been saying, just because it is reckless and misleading. If there are no further questions, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is submitted. That completes our oral arguments for the week, and the clerk will recess the court.